from 6 on 2FM.
Yes, big thank you to the two Johnnies for driving us through this afternoon. It is Thursday, April 6th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, Greg Allen will be dialing in from Augusta, Georgia at the 87th edition of the Masters Tournament. Shane McGrath previews a repeat of last year's All-Ireland Hurling Final as Kilkenny and Limerick do battle in this year's Division 1 League Final. Rebecca Cray is standing by to mark her report card on the League of Ireland Women's Premier Division at the international break and casts her eye towards a tough test for Vera Powell's Ireland team in the USA. Nigel Bidmead has the latest on Frank Lampard's shock return to Chelsea. Leo Cullen chats to Michael Corcoran ahead of Leinster's quarter-final clash with Leicester tomorrow night. And Jeff Shepherd has the latest stateside sports news. Packed show as always. If you want to get in touch, drop us a text 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. Good evening. It's great to have your company. Rebecca Cray is sitting across from me. Bex, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well. Good. We'll be chatting all things soccer in a few moments' time. But first, let us just cross live to Greg Allen at Augusta, Georgia. Greg, you get all the glamour gigs. You are there working diligently at the 87th edition of the Masters Tournament. And Greg, I suppose I was looking through the leaderboard throughout the course of the day. At one stage, we had an Irish amateur leading the way. At one stage, we had the Irish Open champion leading the way. And then at one stage, we had Shane Lowry leading the way. Is that still the case?
All right, you've managed to squeeze in Adrian Maronk there, which is pretty good because he's a very tall 6'7" Pole who actually led here on his own. But you're dead right. Matthew McLean actually got the day off to quite a start because he was in the second match on the golf course and he hit his approach shot on the first after a nice drive down the fairway, left-hand side of the middle fairway, to about 5 feet. And actually, in actual fact, the ball nearly pitched in the hole, rolled out to 5 feet, and he holed that for birdie. Also birdied the fourth, and he was the outright leader of the Masters and two under after four holes. So now he slipped back. Last time I checked, he was three over after 16. He's actually going to be coming in fairly shortly if he's not already just in, and I can tell you that Matthew McLean has dropped a few shots, and as I'm scrolling away trying to find his name,
five over, I believe.
You can see that five over 77. So he took a six on the 17th after I saw him last. So yeah, that's not going to be something that's going to please him after having such a good start. But still, what a Masters debut to be top of the leaderboard, at least for a while, and Matthew McLean around a 77. But obviously, near the top of the leaderboard now, we do have the presence of Shane Lowry, who's just dropped a shot, in fact, on the 11th, which is not the worst thing in the world. It's a very difficult par 4, the start of Amen Corner, and that dropped shot came after a run of three birdies in a row from the 7th, where he hit a beautiful second shot to 30 feet, hold that putt for his first birdie of the day. Second birdie of the day on the 8th, a par 5, long up par 5 up the hill, but he managed to reach the front of the green in two, and then a two putt from around 25 yards, 75 feet. And that really was almost an eagle because it rested right on the edge of the hole, and he had about a 2-inch tap in there for birdie on the 8th. And then on the 9th hole, the par 4, which comes back towards the clubhouse off a downhill lie, tough approach shot apparently, but not for Shane Lowry. He hit it right over the top of the flag to 5 feet and knocked that in. Three birdies in a row. At that stage, he was the outright leader, and then he was joined in the lead by Victor Hovland. And now after a dropped shot for Lowry on the 11th, he's just parred the 12th, Golden Bell, the tough little par 3. He'll be very pleased to have got through Amen Corner, I think, without any great damage. Two under par, heading towards a 13th and 15th, two par 5s to come. There certainly are scoring opportunities, but also a few difficult holes. As we saw, 17 and 18 have always been challenging holes, and they are to come yet for Shane Lowry. Two under, tied for third place after 12 holes, Shane Lowry. Hovland leads on five under. John Rahm with a run of a birdie on the 7th, an eagle on the 8th, par in the 9th, and he's gone to the turn in 33. So Hovland 5 under after 10, John Rahm 3 under after 9, and then Shane Lowry in the group on 2 under par, tied for 3rd place. Lowry now playing that 13th hole, the par 5, which has been elongated with a 35-yard addition to the tee box there, so it's not the easy par 5 that it has been over the years. A good start too for Seamus Power, and he's just got back the shot that he dropped, so he's back to 1 under par inside the top 10. He actually bogeyed the first hole, but on the second from around 250 yards, absolutely speared a long iron. I was there and watched it and literally rested within 5 feet of the flag, just rested past the flag, 5 feet, downhill putt, and Seamus Power eagled the second hole and had all pars towards the turn, bogeyed the 10th, but has just birdied the 11th, one of the toughest holes in the course. So Seamus Power back into the top 10, tied for 9th place, one under, going towards Golden Bell, that little 12th hole par 3. And as just said about Matthew McLean, a 5 over par 77, and we've just got about 40 minutes, 45 minutes or so before Rory McIlroy tees off in what are at the moment really good scoring conditions, but this weather is set to deteriorate according to the forecast. It's warm and mid-80s, as they say around here. They work in Fahrenheit, so about 28 degrees, 29 degrees here centigrade, and that means that it's perfect scoring at Augusta conditions with Shane Lowry on 2 under par, just 3 off the lead in a tie for 3rd place. And obviously Seamus Power just one shot further back on 1 under par, and Tiger Woods, just to reflect on the toils of Tiger Woods, finding it difficult to walk around here. He said that in the 2 9-hole practice rounds, he is back on 2 over par through 10 holes. So lots of Masters golf to go between now and the weekend, but it's good to have two Irishmen in the top 10 and one man just in a tie for 3rd place, Shane Lowry on 2 under. The leader still, Victor Hovland on 5 under.
Great stuff, Greg. We will be checking in with you just before 7 o'clock. Rory McIlroy will be out on the course by then, so we will chat to you then, Greg.
Game on. Rugby.
But as we turn our attention to rugby and team news from Leinster ahead of their Champions Cup quarter-final tomorrow night against the Leicester Tigers. And Caelan Dorris has been named an open side flanker in place of the injured Josh Van der Flier. World Player of the Year Van der Flier misses out with an ankle injury suffered in last weekend's win over Ulster, while fellow Ireland back row Dorris returns in the 7 shirt after missing the last 2 Leinster games through injury. Elsewhere, as expected, Gary Ringrose returns at second centre with Jimmy O'Brien moving to the wing in place of Jordan Larmour, while the rest of the side remains unchanged from that win over Ulster, with James Ryan remaining as captain. Earlier today, our own Michael Corcoran caught up with Leinster head coach Leo Cullen.
Game on, rugby.
Leo, both teams named for the game tomorrow night. It's a pretty short week. How have you had to tailor what you've done this week to prepare for this game tomorrow night?
It's always tricky because you're just trying to get guys back moving really at the start of the week. Mentally being able to turn the page quite quickly, so get the game out of your system, mentally and physically. New plan installed, and really you get one decent training session, which we did on the Wednesday, light enough there today, and you get ready for the game now tomorrow. So it's great response already in terms of fans. It's fantastic. We get a decent crowd here again. It's a big sort of the dilemma of going to the RDS or coming here, and obviously the way they've set up the stadium to have 27,000 would be great, I think. So there's positive straight away because you get another 8,000 or 9,000 people into the game that wouldn't be able to get to the RDS. So we're hugely excited about the game. It's going to be a great challenge. You look at the 4 quarterfinals, the 8 teams that are left, like, there's such quality there, isn't it? So it's, in many ways, it's a privilege to be there at this stage of the competition still. But for us now, we're just trying to make improvements upon what we did last week. The conditions were a factor last week in terms of trying to play the game ideally the way we wanted to play. So Leicester will pose different challenges to what Ulster posed. So for us, we just try to focus on delivering a big and better performance from ourselves, really, than we did last week, because we have to. That has to be the mindset every week.
A return for Caelan Dorris and Gary Ringrose, but Caelan Dorris at number 7.
Yeah, well, it's great to have the two guys coming back, because I thought they were exceptional during the course of the Six Nations, and such key figures with Ireland now, aren't they? So, Caelan is one we've talked about inside there. He's playing 7. He's hasn't featured as with a 7 on his back before, but in terms of the way we would set up that back rower, so someone always has to be able to move across the back row, and Caelan's the one that would have covered 7 quite a bit for us, even though, as I said, he may be starting as the 8 in the team. So if someone comes into the team, whether Jack or a Max or whoever else, it would be, quite often it would be Caelan that would cover that role. So he does it really, really well for us. So, two hugely experienced guys, and it's great to have them back.
Game on, rugby.
That was Leo Cullen chatting to Michael Corcoran ahead of tomorrow night's eagerly anticipated clash with Leicester. And speaking of Leinster's opponents, Leicester coach Richard Wigglesworth, I should say, starts Mike Brown at fullback with Freddie Stewart moving to the wing. Number 8 Jasper Vise is promoted from the bench following his man of the match performance in their victory over Edinburgh, while former Munster and Ireland forward James Cronin continues at loose head prop. You can watch live coverage of Leinster versus Leicester in the Heineken Champions Cup tomorrow night on RTÉ2 and the RTÉ Player, or you can listen to the live commentary on RTÉ Radio 1.
Game on.
Cricket.
Now, before we take a break and chat football, chat hurling, chat US sport, there is some cricket news. And it is good news. Lorcan Tucker became just the 6th wicketkeeper to score a century on debut in men's test cricket and the first to do so in the second innings as Ireland piled on the runs to end day 3 with a lead of 131 runs away to Bangladesh. Having been staring down the barrel of an innings defeat in day 2, Ireland's middle order were imperious as they batted out the day and finished on 286 for 8, having been 51 for 5 in the morning session. So good recovery there. Harry Tector scored a second half century of the match and Andy McBrien became the 3rd Ireland batter to register a maiden test half century in the match as he ended the day on 71 not out. The records tumbled while Tucker was at the crease first, building an Ireland record 5th wicket partnership with Tector before putting on 111 with McBrien, the second highest partnership ever for Ireland in Test cricket. Tucker's 108 was also the second highest Test score for Ireland. He joins Kevin O'Brien as the only 2 players to have scored Test centuries for Ireland, and Ireland will resume tomorrow, sensing a small opportunity for a Test match victory. Bangladesh still needing 2 wickets to end the Irish innings, with the lead approaching 150. Football's up next. We're with Rebecca Cray and Nigel Bidmead.
Game on.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game on this Thursday evening. Nigel Bidmead will be dialing in from England with the latest on Frank Lampard's return to Chelsea in a few moments' time. But first, Rebecca Cray, we are looking forward to the Republic of Ireland taking on the USA in 2 international friendlies. It is international friendlies means an international break for the League of Ireland Women's Premier Division. Now, Louise Craven was on last week with me and we had a look back at the matches, and there was a full set of fixtures the day previous on the Wednesday. So I suppose what we've tasked you with is getting your pen and paper out and giving a bit of a report card and a roundup as to how things stand. I would say after round 5, but because there are an uneven amount of teams, I mean, Wexford have only played 3 matches, a lot of teams have played 4, Piemont and Shells have played 5, they're the top 2. So I suppose overall, when you look at that table, Piemont top, 2 points clear of Shells, then it's Shamrock Rovers, both on 10 points. Rovers have a game in hand. Bowes, Galway, Wexford, Athlone, DLR, Treaty, Cork and Sligo. I suppose from looking at it, for the most part, that's a table that a lot of people would expect. I mean, who's impressed you most and who has been the most disappointing, might be a tough word, after just a handful of games, but perhaps who you might have expected a brighter start from?
Yeah, looking at the table, you know, I didn't expect to see the likes of Athlone Town in 7th place. I think judging off the season they had last year, I was expecting them to come out, you know, all guns blazing this year and really give it a go. I know, look, we're only early in the season. You know, they still have the likes of Maddie Gibson, Muireann Devaney, and now they've got Chloe Singleton, who's come in from Galway. You know, they're still thereabouts, but I definitely expected them to be further up the table at this point in the league. I suppose one team that I didn't expect or have impressed me is Galway. I very much think I personally underestimated them, maybe the rest of the league did too. You know, I know watching them against Shells when they played them there and beat them in Tolka, you know, they were just dogged and they just kept going at Shells. And look, they're not you know, the most technically gifted, you know, footballing team, but they get the results and the shows in their last 2 games, you know, especially in their last result there after, you know, they beat Athlone Town 2-1. So yeah,
can they last the course though? Like, is this, you know, we speak about, yes, it's only after a handful of games, but when you get into the latter stages and you have the experience of Piemont and Shells, you have a host of international players playing for Shamrock Rovers as well.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. Look, you don't know, like, so early, it's very hard to judge, especially looking at the way it's set up at the minute. As you said, look, it is, although it's not a long season game wise, you know, it's kind of drawn out throughout the year with the breaks, with the internationals and World Cup and things like that. It will be interesting to see if they can last it. As you said, the likes of Piemont, Shells, you know, obviously Rovers have the Likes of Anya and Steph in there now to give them that little bit of experience. And again, you've Wexford, you know, they're in a position now I don't think they may be expecting themselves to be, you know, being in sixth. But again, these kind of table standings, you know, they don't mean too much currently. It's only kind of now hitting around the September.
You tell that to Piemont United.
I know. That's all I'm going to tell them. No, I am. But yeah, look, as I said, it is quite early days. You know, it's a long, long season. Injuries can happen, you know, breaks with the international setups, all that kind of stuff comes into play as well. So
There are a couple of players, well, a good few players actually included in the women's national team. Jesse Stapleton, Tara O'Hanlon, Anya O'Gorman, Alana McAvoy and Abby Larkin, who play currently in the League of Ireland. So I suppose they're the obvious ones. So the trickier question for you is, who's caught your eye, perhaps not from the obvious ones that have been given the call up, and what players, without singling anyone out in terms of like talking down on them, you know, that's not what I'm asking you, but in terms of who might have a point to prove, who'll want to really just get back out on the pitch now after the opening few games?
Yeah, like judging off the first few, I know she's an underager at the minute. The likes of Leah O'Leary has really impressed me. I think I mentioned her in previous shows since leaving Shells, she seems to have kind of just excelled in her game. You know, I don't know if that's a confidence thing. She seemed to really push on. I'm not saying she's gonna, you know, push for a senior position, but she has really impressed me this season so far. Another one then, you know, obviously Shells is Alex Kavanagh. You know, and Megan Smith Lynch as well has really put it in, I suppose. Knowing them, you know, they've put in a lot of time and effort in the off season to improve their game and get extra fit. And, you know, looking at Alex's game now compared to, say, this time last year, it's come on leaps and bounds, you know. And like, that's not saying she's never or not always been a great footballer, but just in her whole way of approaching football, you know, she's got her head in the right place, you know, she's really fit and she's stayed on top of things in the off season. So I personally would love to see her step up. I know she's been in home based training sessions. I'd love to see her push on eventually throughout the year. I'm not saying for summer either, but you never know. With the people coming in now, the Irish team currently, you really don't know. So yeah,
that is the broader discussion, and we will talk about who's in the Ireland team and the new faces that are coming in from abroad and not necessarily taking the traditional route. Now, having said that, I think I saw a tweet today from the League of Ireland Twitter of 18 current or former League of Ireland women players featured for the Irish women's national team in World Cup qualifying. So 18 is a large number. Yeah. There are some new faces as well. But there is, you know, you do kind of have to think in the back of your mind, yes, this is a World Cup coming up. Yes, this is historic. Yes, we're going to enjoy it. But the likes of Alex Kavanagh, Leah O'Leary and Jamie Thompson has been mentioned, a couple of players, not alone, and whoever else, like, that this is a process that women's football doesn't just stop at the World Cup. I mean, this is something that we're going to want to build on. Yeah. I'm going to want to continually improve.
Yeah, most definitely. Like, I know the aim now for the international scene is going to be, you know, competing in these kind of competitions every 2-4 years, whatever it may be. You know, we will look to excel now from this qualification. And obviously, there's a lot of young players coming through the National League now. You know, obviously, there's underage National leagues with the under-17s, under-19s, you know, who's feeding now into senior teams. And look, we have to kind of remember that. You know, I know it's all great now with the summer coming up and we want to go and do well in the World Cup, being our first time there. And, you know, as I said, you have these people coming out of the woodworks from all over the world. Currently, you know, I've nanas and grandas here, there and everywhere. They're saying, which is, look, if they can play football and they're going to improve the team as a whole, happy days. But you do have to feel for, you know, those girls who've been on the fringes, the likes of Saoirse Noone, and, you know, is probably sitting at home going, what do I do? How do I get in here? So that has to be tough to take. You know, and as well with some girls maybe that are in the National League, you know, currently playing, you know, they might be looking, going, I'm doing everything I can here, but, you know, girls are just being picked up with passports. But again, we don't know what happens in the background, you know, with admin. That could have been something that's happening long before.
And to be fair, I think Vera Powell and the Irish have said that this was something in the pipeline, that it was a case of trying to get things over the line, that it wasn't just a case of once Ireland qualified that everyone all of a sudden,
because
there is that kind of perception. Yes, there is frustration, obviously, but it's to find that balance. Is what's happening now, I suppose the flip side of that, is it short-sighted in any way in terms of not, if a player came in that hasn't played for Ireland, that has a bit of experience, might be an older player, bringing them to a World Cup and say if they play matches or not, they'd be part of the squad. Would it be a bit more beneficial, perhaps, I'm playing devil's advocate here, to bring a Leo O'Leary or to bring an Alex Havner or someone, just to get that bit of experience and to bring them along in that journey that, you know, yes, we want to perform at the World Cup,
I suppose,
but there's a bigger picture at play as well.
Exactly. Like these players are still going to be around in 4 years' time. They're young enough to know that they still have got a long career ahead of them in the football, you know, domestic leagues anyway. Internationally, you know, I don't think the likes of Alex has even, you know, I suppose got a good run on it, at a senior level at least. And you have got, you know, players throughout the league who are probably looking at it the exact same way. It is a slight short-sighted approach. Again, you know, I'd love to be in Vera's head, because you're kind of thinking to myself, is she just looking at the next 3 months now, or next 4, 5, 6, whatever it is, you know, where is she going to be post-summer? You know, is she going to still be around? You know, I don't know what way she's looking at it. It would be brilliant. I know it might be a case that she's bringing the likes of O'Hanlon in and McAvoy to say, right, here we've got, you know, two extras come on board now from the Women's National League. That's our job done. You know, I hope it's not that. I hope it's done off merit. I hope, you know, she's looked at them and seen how good they are throughout the season so far. Maybe it's a bit short-sighted, but again, you know, you do want to bring your strongest team. And if she feels that, look, it's these girls who are coming around, or she's watched over the last few weeks and months, so be it. You know, we obviously can all have our opinions on it, but at the end of the day, she makes the decisions.
Yeah. And it's not, you see Jesse Stapleton and Abby Larkin, I suppose, is the prime example of bringing young players over to World Cup. And it is Vera's job and the Irish team to do well at this World Cup. And it is the broader picture of developing, putting resources into underage and grassroots and so on, and developing. And that has something that is being done brilliantly by the League of Ireland. And you mentioned it with the underage leagues and so on, and the wealth of talent there as well. What are you expecting from the USA versus Republic of Ireland? So we play our first friendly on Saturday, kick off 7:30 Irish time live on RT2, and then on Tuesday, kick off is at 12:30 live on RT2 as well. So the first match in Texas, the second match in Missouri. Will this be a wake-up call, or will this be kind of where we're at heading into a World Cup?
Yeah, like with these kind of games, like, I think you want to prepare as best as possible going into a World Cup. You know, it's very much, you know, we don't know the territory we're going into, because none of the girls have been in that position before to play in a World Cup or any kind of major tournament at that. I don't know about wake-up call. It might be a little bit of a, you know, run around, let's just say. We all know how good the USA have been. I don't know if they're still as good as they were when they were winning all these World Cups and, you know, major tournaments that they have won. But again, you know, with the likes of this Irish team, you know, they have got a good group there. They will love that underdog kind of name.
Yeah,
that's put on them. I can't see it being a win, obviously, for Ireland.
But a learning experience. Oh, like, 100%. These are, yeah. I know Vera always says about, we want to test ourselves against the best players and the best teams, and that's who they're going to come up against. Like Sam Kerr had a quote, the Australian striker, of, she has goosebumps thinking about that opening match as well. So we play the USA, we play Zambia then in Tala, which will be, with respect, not as big as a challenge as the USA. But France is going to be a pretty tough test as the farewell match before you head off to the World Cup as well. So it's finding that balance.
100%. Yeah. What better way to play or to prep yourself than play against the champions or ex-champions of the World Cup, you know? It will be, if it's not a win, it's always going to be a learning curve, you know? If anything, they'll learn where they're at as a squad. She may give minutes to players that have just recently come in. It will be interesting to see what way she's going to, you know, pick the team. I'm sure she's delighted to see the likes of Katie is up and walking, and, you know, she's got Roisin Littlejohn in the background there, hopefully coming back in. I know she had a recent injury as well, and you know, it'll be very intrigued to see what team she picks to start off.
You mentioned Katie and her Lazarus-like recovery. And listen, you've been on the show a couple of times, and I haven't picked your brain on it. Like, you would have played football with Katie since years were off. 15 and teenagers.
Since she was, yeah,
since
I would have been
a little
bit older.
Yeah. Since you were teenagers, basically. So you know Katie inside out. Like, what sort of character is she? Like, I'm just trying to get a feel for her, because she's such a leader on the pitch. Was she always like that? Even off the pitch, was she always kind of the focus, and not the centre of attention, but just that kind of real figurehead?
She tried to be. No. If I had yellow cards in my hand off the pitch, she'd be getting them as well. No, she's always was quite a confident, I don't like calling her a kid because she's older now, but yeah. Like she was always that, you know, cheeky. She has got that, like she would have had a mouth on her even when she was younger, you know, and I don't think it helped having the likes of myself and Noel Murray beside her given all that either, you know.
Bad so influences.
She learned from herself, I'm sure, but yeah, she always had that air of kind of, you know, confidence about her, and like she was fearless in her approach to football. Like I used to love playing with the likes of her. I used to have herself on my left, Siobhan Killeen on the right, you had Noel and Claire Shine up ahead of you, you know, myself and Rachel Graham sitting in midfield. So when you think of that kind of team, and you know, Katie just used to get on the ball and just go at players fearlessly week in, week out, and more times than not she'd have a shot and I used to scream at her and go mad and the whole lot because she could have crossed it. But yeah, look, she's a great girl, like, and I've obviously got loads of time for her being a friend. I have to no, I'm only messing.
You can also throw her under the bus being a friend
I will at some point. But yeah, now look, she, you know, she's worked hard to get to where she is now. You know, I think getting the captaincy so young has brought another level to her game. You know, she was always quite, you know, as I said, fearless, skillful, but she's just got, believe it or not, a little bit more level-headed. I know when she was a little bit younger, she might have been just a little bit more fiery than she is now. But
did that help her when she was younger, being that fiery and a bit on edge, playing on the edge? And
yeah, I think so. I think again, like she knew her boundaries. You know, she knew to push it to a certain limit. She knew, I think, the ability she had. She knew she was quite good. You know, and I think it was always written in the stars for her to get to the levels that she's at now. It's still quite surreal watching her, you know, and watching her week in, week out play and score goals like she did the other day with that left foot. I don't know how she came back round after 4 days. Yeah. You know, they must have miracles or holy water and the medical staff. But look, she did. And I was only talking to her the day after it happened. She went for the X-ray straight away, MRI. So you have to remember, like, Arsenal are a top, top club with top medical staff. And, you know, I'm sure they done everything in their power to get her ready for that game and get her back. So, look, it's great to have a Katie McCabe on your side, along with Denise O'Sullivan and Louise Quinn and Courtney Brosnan, whoever else is in that squad. You know, and it's going to be an exciting few weeks and months ahead.
Absolutely. Listen, I would love to say chatting about that. But just my final question, was that a Raheny team you were describing there with Noel?
Yeah, that was a Raheny team. There's Pierce Slattery in behind us, Niamh Burke and goal, yes. Megan Campbell on the left end, yeah. So.
Not a
good
bad
little,
team.
Good little sides.
Yeah, decent.
Sorry.
Decent. Okay, Rebecca, you're staying around because I want to bring Nigel Bidmead into the conversation because there was some small bit of news over in England today, and that is that Chelsea have appointed Frank Lampard as their interim manager in what is a stunning return to Stamford Bridge as the club continued to search for a permanent replacement for Graham Potter. Lampard is ready to help on a short-term basis at Chelsea, where he played for more than a decade and was sacked as the head coach in January 2021. So, Nigel, nice, easy question for you. Chelsea Football Club, just explain what is happening. It's bizarre stuff.
It's nuts. It's completely nuts, Shane. It really is. But I think actually there's a bit of logic behind this move, because having sacked Graham Potter, who was struggling, you know, to win games, to score goals, and most importantly, struggling with the crowd. You know, the fans had lost faith in him. So Todd Boehly, the co-owner, you know, is left with this situation where the Premier League has got away from them in terms of qualifying for Europe, especially the Champions League, but they do have this really important Champions League tie coming up against Real Madrid. Now, Bruno, who was put in charge for a game, he didn't want the job. He was clearly uncomfortable in his press conference and talking to the press. The team performed okay on Tuesday against Liverpool. They played with a lot of heart. They didn't score a goal, but neither did Liverpool. So, you know, there was a little bit of encouragement there. So for the Chelsea owners, they're in a difficult position. Do they get a big name in who comes in, you know, with three quarters of the season gone and on a hiding to nothing? Or do they go for this option? Frank Lampard, as you mentioned, Shane, is a club legend, 13 years a Chelsea player, scored loads of goals, one of the leading scorers in the Premier League. And he knows the club, he knows some of the players, he's got a coaching staff with him, he's going to bring a couple of guys with him who know the club inside out, including Paul Clement, who spent a couple of years as an assistant coach at Real Madrid. So there is some logic to this. And I think the overriding thing is it also appeases the fans. because the fans at Stamford Bridge were getting fed up with Potterball. You know, it wasn't going anywhere, and they were voicing their opinion, not just in the last week or so, but, you know, over the last 6 weeks or so. So to appoint Frank Lampard keeps the fans on side, gets a lot of the players, especially the younger ones, on side, who will remember Frank Lampard, you know, as a coach, and some of those players have been at the club for a very long time. So there is logic behind it, but to perhaps somebody who doesn't add all that up, it just seems like it's completely out of control.
Yeah, I'm not having it. There's no logic in Chelsea Football Club. On a serious note, is this until the end of season, regardless if Lampard goes on to win every Premier League match, wins the Champions League, like, is there a case where he could be considered as a full-time, long-term successor, or is it a case of no conversations are happening with Nagelsmann, Enrique, Pochettino, and so on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Luis Enrique was reportedly in London yesterday to have a chat to the Chelsea hierarchy. Mauricio Pochettino is in just about every conversation when a top job comes up in anywhere around the world. So, you know, it depends, I think, what happens during Frank Lampard's tenure, that if they agree terms with, say, for example, Luis Enrique, you know, for him to come in, do a pre-season, start in earnest next season, then there is no future for Frank Lampard. But if they can't get anybody or anybody that they want, then there's a possibility. I think it's remote. I think probably the best fit for the club would be Pochettino, given what he did at Spurs in terms of giving youth a chance and giving the team some identity and changing the culture at the club and taking Tottenham all the way to a Champions League final. So, you know, if it was me who was in charge, I'd be looking at Pochettino, but he might be looking at that going, no, I will wait for the Real Madrid job because, you know, perhaps Carlo Ancelotti is coming towards the end of his time there and maybe, you know, he's been linked with the Brazil national team job. So there's quite a few high-profile jobs coming up. I would doubt that Frank Lampard would get one of them.
Indeed. Well, at the moment, he has one of them for the foreseeable future anyway. Nigel Bidmead, thank you very much for taking the call. Will be very interesting to see how Frank Lampard's tenure goes at Chelsea. Nigel, Rebecca, thank you both very much. We're going to take a short break and then we're going to be chatting hurling with Shane McGrath.
Game on.
Hurling.
Now, Shane McGrath joins me on the line to preview the Division 1 Hurling League final on a weekend that the Gaelic Football Championship starts. It's wild stuff, Shane. This is some planning. But I'm very much looking forward to Kilkenny versus Limerick this Sunday. It should be a cracking match. We haven't had too many cracking matches over the course of the league campaign. Will this be a proper blazing battle?
Yeah, just in regards to, with the fixture, Shane, I'd agree with you. For me, maybe Saturday night would be a better option. There's not much on hurling-wise Saturday night, and I suppose a lot of people are maybe giving up about the venue as well. For me, the venue, Páirc Uí Chaoimh is the right place, is the best stadium, best pitch to have it on it. When it's not in Croke Park. And that's with all due respect to what's going on in Thurles. I think there's a lot of work has to be done in Thurles, Shane, as regards the surroundings. And I'm talking about the stands and shops and things like that, the facilities. And there is that ball is in motion. But anyway, that's a story for another day. But I do think maybe Saturday night would have been better. Do I think it's going to be a competitive final? I really do, yeah. Because I think, like, say, you get to a national final, Shane, everybody wants to win. You have two teams coming in with, you know, they have momentum on their side. They're both nearly at full, getting back to full strength now, albeit Kilkenny don't have TJ or Adrian Mullen yet. But, like, I just think that it has all the makings of a great game. And I suppose if there is one team that have done and can kind of hang in there when the going gets tough against Limerick, it has been Kilkenny the last few years. So for all those reasons, Shane, I do think, you know, the last few meetings they've had and things like that, and it being a national final, I do feel we're going to get a really good game on Sunday.
Hopefully. I know Owen Cody was out in media duty today and speaking about to be the best, you have to play the best and beat the best and so on. And the last year's All-Ireland final, I think, was the first time since 2019 or something that they played as well. So it's, they want to test themselves and see what they're about. I mean, tactically, what does Derek Ling and his Kilkenny team have to do to try and muzzle Limerick?
Sure, like, you have to bring a ferocious work rate, like, for 75 minutes. I mean, you see with the Tip Boys last day, they probably brought it for maybe 55 minutes, and then Limerick just, you know, they took over and they dominated. Then So it has to be, that has to be the first thing anyway, that has to be your number one at the top of your list. You just have to match them physically and for work rate and, you know, turnovers and things like that. The other thing then for me is like efficiency, like against them. I mean, if you take, I was just looking up there, and credit to GA Statsman there on Twitter, he puts up great stuff. Kilkenny got off 30 shots from open play against Cork, but they only scored 11 of them, Shane, right? So to beat Limerick, if you're taking 30 shots from play, you probably need to be scoring 18 or 19 of them. So work rate, efficiency, and the third thing is, I do think feel they're going to need a couple of goals to try and beat Limerick. You know, again, go back to Tip semi-final, I suppose, Tip scored 14 goals going into that game, but they never took one shot in open play on Nicky Quaid. And that's because maybe a lot of teams, Shane, are playing two in the full forward line, or maybe one up there sometimes, because they're trying to kind of match him in the middle third. And I feel that Kilkenny, even if you look back at the All-Ireland final last year, Kilkenny, they did score goals and they had three lads in the full forward line. So I do feel you need bodies up there. And you do probably need three guys up there to try and score a goal against, you know, the defence that they have. So look, there you go. Work unbelievably hard, score most of their shots from play and a couple of goals, and sure, there you go, there's your answer. And hope Limerick don't do the same. Like,
it's Derek Ling, if you're listening, Shane McGrath has cracked John Kiely.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like a Pandora's box here, but like, I mean, look, there you go. And then you have to hope, Shane, you have to hope that they don't have their A game. You have to nearly hope that they're a little bit below par, like, for all this world. And that's you having your top game, 15 guys really going at it, and fight three or four guys can make a difference, and still hoping that they're not at their best. Because if they're at their best, a lot of other teams' best probably won't beat them, do you know? And that's with all due respect to everyone, and I think that's the ultimate compliment we can give this Limerick team. Like,
if Limerick are at their best, do Kilkenny stand no chance, even if they are at the top of their game, just considering where both panels are?
Yeah, I wouldn't think no chance, because I think, like, even go back to Ireland final or when they've played them, Kilkenny, they're a brilliant team at hanging in there when the opposing team has a purple patch. And when Limerick have a purple patch, if you take it, like, they outscore Tip 113 to 4 points from half time to the 55th minute in the second half, right? Like, Kilkenny are really good at hanging in there and at chipping away, at getting scores, you know, getting a free here or there, getting a point from play, just hanging in there, keeping within three or four. Because, you know yourself, Shane, when Limerick or any dominant team in any sport, if they can sense, you know, that there's a chance for the kill, they'll go for it, like, you know. And if they get 5 points ahead, before you know it, they're 7 or 8 points ahead. But I think Kilkenny are really, really good at hanging in there and keeping within 3 or 4 points all the time. And that's why I feel that, you know, even if Limerick do come at it and give a phenomenal performance, I do think Kilkenny have the ability and the players. And I suppose that word that Brian Cody always uses and Derek Ling uses, I'm sure, is spirit. They really do have that, like, and I think they will be able to keep it in touch and distance of them. Like,
it's funny you mentioned the GA Statsman, because I was reading a couple of stats on last year's All-Ireland final, which was the joint highest scoring final in history, equaling the total of 66 points scored in the 2021 final between Limerick and Cork, and had the most scores, so 60 scores in a final, surpassing the 58 scores of the 21 final as well. And Kilkenny, who scored 226, was the highest total for a losing team in a final. So when you speak about sticking in there and staying in the battle, staying in the hunt, Kilkenny epitomised that. I mean, you go through all the All-Ireland finals, and if they have the highest total for a losing team, they're not going to go away easily, even if they're behind.
No, absolutely not. Like, and you know, and you know, if like the gains they've made, I was down to see Tip Kilkenny in the league in Nolan Park in February, and that day just nothing went right from they're you know, they've kind of tweaked their system, they're working it through the line a little bit more. And what Limerick have in Barry Nash, Kilkenny have in Padraic Welch. And what do I mean by that is, like, if they are going short from puck out, he's very comfortable on the ball, no more so than Barry Nash is, and he's able to get it to his own or work it through a line. Whereas maybe a lot of the, like, maybe Mikey Butler's job Sunday might be, he might get tagged with the job, Shane, of maybe following Keane Lynch around, right? So if he does, is that going to free up Richie Reid a bit more if he's playing, to kind of play a role similar maybe to what Limerick like Declan Hannan to do, as in being a pocket, being out ball? So I just think, like, that they do have the players around the pitch. You know, like TJ and Adrian Mullen are a massive loss from the All-Ireland final last year, but, you know, Billy Drennan has stepped up, and, like, we spoke about Billy Drennan, everybody knows well about him now. He scored 265, he's averaging around 12 points a game, but this will be a massive test for him. Like, he'll maybe on Sean Finn or Mike Casey. And I just think the learnings he'll get, Shane, out of Sunday, being in a national final, you know, a lot of pressure maybe on him because of the performances he's given and the way he stepped up. But like I was saying during the week, like, that maybe what he'll learn on Sunday could be more beneficial to him than maybe actually winning a National League medal. And I think it'll be massive what the experience he'll gain from Sunday, marking, if it is Sean Finn, you know, one of the best cornerbacks ever, and what he'll learn from that, and what he'll learn from playing in a national final and all these things. So to go back to your question, I'm trying to say, they do have a good spread of players around the place. John Donnelly's coming into form. Mossy Keown has ferocious work rate. Owen Cody does as well. Like, will Mossy Keown get tagged with Barry Nash, maybe, to try and shut him down? I think what the rest of the managers, Shane, are looking at is, how are Kilkenny going to go about trying to beat them? And is it going to be that, look, we're going to go man on man, we're going to push on them, and how will Limerick react? And I have no doubt Paul Kinnock has all this thought out, like, but I'm sure Derek Ling and his management team have said, look, will we just go at this now and see where we're at, and maybe have learnings from it if we do meet them again later on in the year. So with all those things said, with all the potential matchups and everything, I just feel it does have the making for a really good Allianz League final. Like,
here's hoping. My final question, probably a very difficult question considering we don't know team news, we're a few days out from throw in, but call it for me.
Well, look, you have to be realistic here. Like, Limerick are serious. I've said that I think this is the strongest they've ever been as a group, Shane, because of what they have challenging the established players. Like, Colin Coughlin's asking questions at the halfback line. Cathal O'Neill, Adam English, Shane O'Brien. Like, I mean, Dan Morrissey mightn't even make their championship team. Seamus Flanagan mightn't even make their championship team. And for all those reasons, because of the group they have and the strength and depth, you know, you can't look past Limerick. I don't think it'll be... they'll win by maybe 9 or 10 points. I think that they will win maybe by that 4 or 5 point margin.
Okay, well, hopefully it will be a cracker. Shane McGrath, thank you very much for taking the call. Or Limerick, I should say, v Kilkenny, of course, throws in on Sunday, the Allianz League Division 1 hurling final. Jeff Shepherd will be dialing in with his Eye on America in 3 minutes' time.
Game on.
Eye on America.
Now, you're very welcome back to the final part of Game On. We will be checking back in with Greg Allen at the Masters very shortly. But first, Jeff Shepherd has his Eye on America. And Shep, let us start with a women's basketball story, because on Sunday, the LSU Tigers won the national championship with a 17-point win over Iowa. But that's not what I want to pick your brain on. What I want to talk about is what happened since the game finished. So, two things, I suppose, have happened after the game that have sparked quite the debate across the country all week long. What is the story?
Yeah, Shane, so Angel Reese, who plays for LSU, she was having fun at the end of the game. I mean, she's about to be a national champion. And, she made some gestures toward Iowa's best player, Caitlin Clark, who was, you know, hands down, you know, the best, you know, player in all of the tournament, really kind of captivated the country as Iowa made their run to the finals. One of which was, if you're familiar with wrestling and you know who John Cena is, you know, the rubbing your hand in front of somebody's face, you know, it's called the "you can't see me" hand gesture. You know, it's no big deal, but I don't know, some people maybe got a little upset about it. And then afterwards, after the game, you know, she was kind of pointing to her ring finger, very similarly to how Joe Burrow did when he was the quarterback at LSU when they won the football championship in 2019. And, I, Shane, I don't know if just people are more sensitive these days. I don't, which it's kind of hard to be more sensitive. But, I mean, people kind of, you know, got a little upset and got into a hissy fit, you know, online and on social media talking about, you know, taunting and, you know, sportsmanship and different things like that. To Caitlin Clark's credit, she came out and said, I don't understand why anyone's, you know, messing with Angel. You know, she's a competitor. I'm a competitor. I don't think it really needs, you know, that should, you know, this should be made into such a big deal. You know, I mean, it's what happens in the heat of competition. And I will say, Caitlin Clark, you know, on her way to the finals, she talked a lot of smack and did some hand gestures herself as well. So, you know, I think it was all in good fun between Angel Reese and Clark. I mean, I think she was trying to prove the point that, hey, we're the better team. And they did that by 17 points. I don't think that left any, you know, any question in anyone's mind. But the really kind of interesting thing that happened after, Shane, is, you know, it's a tradition in American sports, especially in college sports and most pro teams as well. You get an invitation to go to the White House to go meet the president after you win a national championship or, you know, a title if you're in the pros. And it got floated out that Jill Biden, you know, the First Lady of America, was the United States. She was in attendance at the game on Sunday, and she kind of floated out there that maybe she'd like to have LSU and Iowa there because they both played so well. And boy, did that open up a can. People were not excited about that process. And even the Iowa players were like, why would we want to go? We lost. You know, this is not where we're supposed to be. And Angel Reese even came out and said, you know, she thought it was a joke that they would get invited with the runners up as well. And it seems like the White House has kind of walked that back. And now LSU has said, you know, they'd be happy to go. But I don't think Iowa's going to be there. But, you know, I don't really ever recall, you know, the losing team in a championship getting invited. And, you know, we talk a lot about participation trophies nowadays over here in America with, you know, kids being too soft. This might be like the ultimate participation trophy request, you know, to go visit the White House after you lost.
Well, it will be interesting to see how that one. It's very an interesting story, I suppose, overall, with the many subplots to it. Now, I didn't think I'd be segueing, mentioning John Cena, but sure, look, here we are. So it leads me on to our next story, because the WWE and the UFC will combine to form a $21.4 billion sports entertainment company. Like, what? This staggering figures, I suppose, but will we see changes to how they operate and how they entertain fans?
Well, first and foremost, Shane, longtime listeners of this program and my segments, they know how much I love the WWE and how wonderful of a product it is. And many fine Irish wrestlers are heavily involved, you know, in the product to this day, with Becky Lynch and Sheamus. And of course, we've seen Conor McGregor and whatnot. So just putting that out there that, you know, it is a wonderful product. But yeah, it got announced this week. Look, there'd been a lot of rumors about, you know, what the McMahon family wanted to do with the product. Vince McMahon's in his 80s. It seems like, you know, the kids were potentially interested in selling. You know, maybe the Saudis might, somebody in the Saudi family might be interested in purchasing it. But they're going to merge with Endeavor, which owns the UFC, into one big company, and Vince McMahon gets to stay on as the chairman. Endeavor's headed up by Ari Emanuel, if you're familiar with the television show Entourage. The agent character's based on him. Look, I don't think you're going to see marked changes really in either league. I think it's just about, you know, they're similar sports in some aspects. They're different in others, obviously. But I think, you know, there's a lot of crossover with the fans. And I think they feel like there's probably a lot of potential, you know, for synergies when it comes to marketing and tickets and just, you know, those types of things. I don't necessarily think you're going to see any major changes. Maybe you have some crossover events with, you know, UFC guys going and doing some WWE stuff. You know, we've had WWE guys, you know, go on and do stuff in UFC. Ronda Rousey obviously came from UFC to WWE. So there are some similarities kind of already there. I think it made a lot of sense from the owners of the companies to kind of get this all under one tent. And look, I think the fans are going to win out. It's still going to take a year and a half or so before, you know, we really know what we're getting into here. But you're right, it's big numbers, and there's a lot of eyeballs that'll be interested in this.
Absolutely. Shep, your gentleman, thank you very much for checking in with us. Before we go, time to check in with Greg Allen, because Greg, we were chatting at the top of the show, and Shane Lowry, Seamus Power were going well, and Victor Hovland was leading the way. What has changed since we last spoke?
What's changed is Shane Lowry has just holed a 42-foot putt on the 15th green, the par 5, for a birdie, which got him back to 3-under par, and he's put together a gorgeous round of golf, beautiful round of golf. Birdies in the 7th, 8th and 9th. That trio of birdies got him out in 33. There was a bogey on the 11th, but it's one of the toughest holes in the course, which I was saying a bit earlier, and he's just got that shot back with the birdie on the 15th, the 550-yard par 5 Firethorn, it's called, and that's got him back into a tie for second place alongside Xander Schauffele, John Rahm, and now Brooks Koepka. That quartet are all on 3-under par, but Victor Hovland is racing away, 4 shots clear. He's 7-under after a birdie a few moments ago in the 13th, an eagle and 5 birdies. The Hovland, the world number 9 from Norway, has a 4-stroke lead over Lowry, Schauffele, Rahm and Koepka, and going very nicely, Seamus Power in the group on 2-under par with a birdie on the 13th hole just about 15 minutes ago, par the 14th. Power is now at tied for 6th place on 2-under par. He holed a 75-foot putt from the front to the back of the 11th green, so that really got him into a position where he is right now inside the top 10. Matthew McLean, he shot a round of 77, 5 over par, and Rory McIlroy's first drive of the Masters into the trees, left on the first, so he's in trouble already. But he's only 138 yards from the hole, he could well save par from there.
Great stuff. Okay, Greg, unfortunately that is all we have time for. We will be checking in with you tomorrow, again at the top of the show, and finishing out our show tomorrow on Good Friday with Greg Allen. Greg, gentlemen, as always, really appreciate it. Sinead, that is all we have time for. Betta da Silva is coming up next, but for myself, Laura Lee Davis, our BCO, Andrew O'Connor, our producer, and all of the Game On team, have a very good evening.